Hey everyone, Patrick here. I wanted to make this quick intro before the actual show because I didn't want to bog down the time we had with our guest. This week, we tried something new and had with us Kevin Hutchings, a professor of English from the University of Northern British Columbia. He was gracious enough to come on and tell us about Ojibwe writer George Kapwe, or as he's known by his Ojibwe name, Kagegagabo, who was a rather important figure at the time he was alive in the 1840s. Professor Kevin Hutchings holds an appointment as University Research Chair at UNBC. He teaches courses in British Romantic, Environmental, Postcolonial, and Transatlantic Literatures. Kevin has published 6 books, including Imagining Nature, Blake's Environmental Poetics, and Romantic Ecologies and Colonial Cultures in the British Atlantic World. His latest title, Transatlantic Upper Canada, Portraits in Literature, Land, and British Indigenous Relations, was published by McGill Queen's University Press in 2020. And it's that book that, you know, allowed me to reach out to him in the first place, or encouraged me to, rather. In his spare time, Kevin even writes, performs, and records music. He has 6 indie music albums, including Songs of William Blake, which came out in 2007, and Truth to Power in 2019. While we might not necessarily touch upon his music, I think a lot of his ideas concerning British Romanticism, environmentalism, post-coloniality, I think a lot of these come up in the discussion and mesh together really well when we talk about a Ojibwe Methodist writer like Kapwe. So I hope you enjoy the show, and obviously we can't forget to plug a few things. You can check out the Patreon if you want early shows and uncut shows, or even extra shows. We have Pop Canada over there that's led by Mac. You can also support the show with a pay what you like kind of idea through PayPal. And, you know, just like the show, subscribe it, leave a review, all that good stuff. It helps grow the show and get it to more listeners' ears. All right, I've talked your ear off enough. I'm going to let Professor Hutchings do a lot of the further talking. I'll see you at the end, maybe for some final thoughts. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Historia Canadiana. My name is Patrick, and with me, as always, is my phenomenal co-host, Mackenzie.
Hello.
And with us today, for what is probably quite the first on the show, is Professor Kevin Hutchings from the University of Northern British Columbia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patrick and Mackenzie. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So Kevin is here on the show to talk to us and kind of help us through a discussion of an interesting Ojibwe writer called George Kapwe, who was most prominent in the 1830s and 40s in Upper Canada. And yeah, I think we're going to have a pretty interesting discussion that's pretty much a follow-up of our last episode, which talked about conversion methods and ideas of creating images of the other as it was seen in New France. So where that took place in the 17th century, we're going to be discussing obviously the 19th century as it was seen by in British North America and specifically in Upper Canada. So just to get us started, Professor Hutchings, before we actually started recording, you mentioned that you wanted to explain a bit how you got interested into George Kapwe and why you would necessarily include him, for example, in one of your latest works, Transatlantic Upper Canada, which I started reading. It's quite fascinating, by the way.
Yeah, well, thank you. I came to Kapwe in the wake of having written an application for a Shirk grant, and I wanted to look at colonialism in Upper Canada. And one of the reviewers observed that if I wished to, do a good job with such a project, that I should consider including some Indigenous voices, obviously. And this anonymous reviewer recommended that I look at Gagawakanabe Peter Jones, the Mississauga chief, as well as George Kapwe. So I traveled to Vancouver shortly thereafter, and George Kapwe's autobiography was available in the stacks at Robarts. And I pulled it down. I knew nothing about George Kapwe. I looked at the cover page, and it basically, you know, gave the title, the life, history, and travels of Gogi Gegabo, George Kopwe, missionary to his people, I think it said, and chief Ojibwe nation. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. I didn't realize that George Kopwe had taken some liberties in calling himself a chief, because he wasn't a chief. And I didn't realize that when he published the book, he was no longer a missionary. So I took him at his word, and I read his book, and I just loved it. I one of the things that really captured me, as I got further into his writing, was his penchant for quoting British romantic writers. So Kopwe, I did my PhD in British romantic literature. I wrote a dissertation on William Blake, and I've published on Wordsworth and Coleridge, Mary Shelley, and here I'm reading a book that is, I think it's by an Ojibwe chief, and he's quoting people like Robert Burns and Sir Walter Scott and Robert Southey, the Romantic period poet laureate, and even Carl Schlegel, German romantic, and of course also American romantic authors such as James Fenimore Cooper and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And I just thought my mind was blown. As a literature scholar, I just thought to myself, how did this Ojibwe chief, this Anishinaabe chief, even come to know these authors that I love and that I write about? And that was my entry into Kopwe studies. Well, the first thing I did subsequent to that was to get my hands on what is still probably the most important essay published on George Kopwe, which is Donald Smith's essay published in 1988, where I quickly discovered that George Kopwe was not quite the man he presented himself to be. For me, though, that made him even more fascinating. So I came into Kopwe studies, you know, obviously as a member of Canada's settler society. I was a little bit hesitant to think that I could write with any kind of authority about an Ojibwe autobiographer and historian and ethnographer. But it really was Kopwe's love of romance, of British and American romantic literature, and that really fascinated me. And I felt that as a specialist in those fields, I could bring some knowledge to Kopwe studies. And so since then, I've published several book chapters, and Kopwe has made appearances in a number of other essays that I've written about the environmental and cultural histories of North America, with a particular emphasis on Upper Canada.
Right. We were wondering, right, exactly. This is something that we come face too often when doing the show and when addressing.
Oh my God, yeah. It's very much many episodes constantly. We try to address these issues as much as we can, including this one. We're going to be saying it multiple times that we are not speaking for any First Nations person with these episodes, you know, or we've said it before when we've done episodes on Black authors, episodes on any authors of color, female authors, women authors. We make it very clear we're just two white boys in our 20s trying to present this information as best as we can.
I find it very interesting how, for example, coming back to transatlantic Upper Canada, you incorporated Kopwe into this larger narrative that you were building in as part of your history of, or at least that specific history of Upper Canada, or literary history. Is that something that helped you overcome some of those anxieties of writing about Kopwe that might have shown up, or did you think it was just a natural extension of the way that Kopwe spoke to you as a writer?
Right. Yes, you're correct to point out that my new book, Transatlantic Upper Canada, which came out last fall in 2020, that it is a literary and environmental history of Upper Canada. And basically, the subtitle of the book is Portraits in Literature, Land, and British Indigenous Relations. I was inspired to sort of do a series of portraits by Donald Smith's book, that you know his book Mississauga Portraits, which also has a chapter on George Copway. I thought that it would be interesting to do a set of different portraits that included, for example, a chapter on Bishop John Strawn, you know, who was the first, who was the Archdeacon of York and the first Anglican Bishop of Toronto, and who in my scholarship, I attempted to identify the role that he played in the imperial policy heritage that informed the later development of residential schools in Canada. There was also a chapter on John Beverley Robinson, who was the Chief Justice of Upper Canada and who had a lot of dealings with people like Gagawakanabe Peter Jones, and also a lot of dealings with the Six Nations, a couple of different chiefs there who I write about in that book, John Norton, Tyonenhockerowan, and Chief John Brant. I had a chapter on Sir Francis Bondhead, who imposed a number of treaties on the Anishinaabeg during his very brief tenure in the mid-1830s as the Lieutenant Governor of Upper Canada. And also Anna Brownell Jameson, the famous feminist author who came to Upper Canada in 1837, I believe it was, and toured the province and met, for example, Bemwewe Gijikokwe Jane Johnston Schoolcraft, the Ojibwe poet from Upper Michigan. So also including chapters on George Copway, Peter Jones, as I've said, the Mohawk chiefs, John Norton, John Brant. The thing that really interests me is that a lot of these individuals, George Copway is a bit of an outlier there because he traveled down to the United States, but a lot of these individuals knew each other, had to deal with each other, responded to each other in their published writings. The indigenous author, well, George Copway may not have had a direct relationship with Sir Francis Bondhead, but he certainly talks about Sir Francis Bondhead in his European travelogue. So what I was trying to do was to untangle a kind of a Gordian knot of relationships between and among members of the Settler Society, members of the First Nations, to come up with a different kind of history focused on one of the things that many of those authors share, one of those figures shared, was that a sharing of the fact that they were writers and that they wrote and published literary texts. So George Copway fits really neatly. He's the last. My chapter on Copway has a bit more of a focus on his European travel writing, and it is the chapter that concludes the book before I write the conclusion to try to tie up various loose ends.
I thought that was rather interesting, especially when reading that chapter on Copway. And we might come back to this later because we have other questions that will, but sure. I'm just thinking of stuff as I go along. But this idea of connecting these seemingly disconnected figures was really interesting. And there was a passage in your chapter on Copway where you mentioned that the kind of William Blake influence, in a sense, despite no evidence that, or very little evidence that Copway actually read Blake. So it's interesting that these ideas and that these traditions kind of merge and permeate despite an active will by a lot of these people to do so.
Yeah, Blake had no influence on Copway, but what I'm interested in is some of the ideas that Blake articulates that Copway seems to share with him. For example, you know, one of the things that Donald Smith points out in his really important essays on Copway is the fact that Copway spent a little bit of time in jail in Upper Canada in, I believe it was 1846. And, you know, Copway was not ultimately charged with crimes of embezzling money from the Saugeen and Rice Lake First Nations, you know, and I think the jury is out on you know, his guilt or lack thereof or what actually happened in those circumstances. But Copway himself points out that the prevalence of laws and prisons is in fact a negative commentary on the society where those kinds of things have to proliferate. You know, William Blake famously said that prisons are built with stones of law. He suggests that prohibitive laws actually create the conditions for their own transgression. And Copway himself suggests that, you know, the presence of prisons is a negative. He says that in a traditional Anishinaabe society, there were no prisons because people shared and shared alike. And so there was no need for people to have to be reduced to stealing, for example, because it was a more generous society with a kind of more, if to use a modern phrase, equitable distribution of wealth. Mm-hmm. And societies that such as European societies and then colonial societies who practiced a more individualistic ethic, come in for some critique there. So I'm not suggesting that someone like William Blake, I also compare in other essays, I talk about Copway's possible relationship to, well, Lord Byron, for example. Mm-hmm. And Byron, now there's one that we can actually talk about in terms of a potential influence, because Copway cites and quotes Byron several times in the throughout the course of his oeuvre, and he was really fascinated by Byron. You're quite right. One of the exciting things, for me at least, as a specialist in British Romantic literature, is to try to understand the ways not only in which Romanticism influenced someone like William Blake, but even to try to explore the possible ways in which European Romanticism is itself not a purely European discourse, but a discourse that has been influenced by experiences in the contact zone, and the fact that Romantic writers in Britain, Wordsworth and Coleridge and Southey and Blake, were utterly fascinated with First Nations. Of course, they got most of their information from travel texts and exploration texts authored by European authors. Mm-hmm. But those texts are records of what happens in a contact zone. And Tim Fulford has, in his book Romantic Indians, has made the case that Romanticism is in fact the product of, to a certain extent, of a kind of a cosmopolitan or intercultural space of inquiry, and that Romantic authors such as Wordsworth, to some extent, base their representations of rustic shepherds and other sort of, you know, people who lived in a quote-unquote state of nature on their own mediated understandings of indigenous culture. That's something that really fascinates me.
We've kind of strayed already from what we wanted.
Yeah, we have.
But just to kind of bring it back a bit to our initial idea. So how can we frame exactly the world in which Copway grows up in, right? So we mentioned before he was an Ojibwe, Anishinaabe person. He was born in the early 19th century and grew up in the 1830s and 40s. And so what is the context that we need to be aware of, or the at least broader context that we need to be aware of for the Anishinaabe people? And, you know, how does Copway fit into this exactly? How would you say that?
Yeah, thanks. Good questions. George, one of the greatest problems, of course, that Anishinaabe people faced, and First Nations faced in general, were the pressures brought to bear on the land base by the massive influx of British and other European immigrants in the early decades of the 19th century in particular. And this influx of, for example, I could refer to Copway right away. He was born in at Rice Lake, near the at the mouth of the Trent River, in 1818. In that very year, his people sold almost a million hectares of their traditional hunting territories to the British government for a pittance, something like £750, and then an annuity of just under £3,000. So Copway is born at a time, at a very transitional time in which the land base is shifting. And he was only 7 years old when 2,000 Irish settlers arrived in his people's former territory, in their traditional territory, and of course began to do the hard work of cutting down the trees and carving agricultural homesteads. This fragmentation of ecosystems that's caused not just by the building of farms, but by the building of towns and, you know, ultimately cities, roads, canals, this not only pushes indigenous people off out of their traditional territories and sometimes onto small reserves, but it also causes pressures that make hunting no longer a viable alternative. Hunting and trapping and even foraging, you know, canal building floods the rice fields in some of the lakes. The fragmentation of the land fragments ecosystems that make it difficult for the previous populations of wild animals to thrive. Chief Gagawakanabe Peter Jones says that before the white man arrived, the deer teemed in the thousands on the shores of the southern Great Lakes. But George Copway is born at a time when hunting is no longer a effective way of gaining sustenance. And people like Peter Jones are not only converting Anishinaabe people to Christianity, but are also really dedicated to teaching them how to farm. So these kinds of pressures, you know, Copway and his people are facing them, and Copway is born at this kind of time of great transition. Of course, also when Copway was 12 years old, the missionaries arrived. Chief Peter Jones was a Methodist missionary who came to the Rice Lake area and converted George Copway's parents and ultimately George Copway himself. So George Copway, in the early chapters of his autobiography, he talks about his childhood prior to the arrival of the missionaries. And he talks about, you know, his absolute love of hunting, for example, and his induction into the Meadowiwin Society, the Grand Medicine Lodge, after a successful vision quest. But this sort of development of young young Gagi Gegabo as a traditional Anishinaabe man, suddenly there is a great change when the Christians arrive. And George Copway is converted to Christianity, turns his back on hunting and traditional ritual activities, and eventually becomes a missionary himself and goes out to convert other Anishinaabe.
Something that's also interesting to mention, I think, contextually at this time is, yes, the arrival of settlers through treaties, exactly as you were saying. I think also, and Mac, we have already had a discussion about this, I think, if a couple months ago when we were talking about the pre-Confederation treaties as a whole, the nature around this time of treaty making was changing, right? Mm-hmm. Where it had gone previously to the 1830s, it had started off as dealing with nations relatively one-on-one. There was starting to be a shift. I think I'm correct in my timeline at this point. I could be wrong, but there was starting to be a shift around the 1830s where exactly what you were saying, Kevin, we're dealing with swaths of land now. We're no longer dealing with people. And I think that's a particularly fascinating point to bring up. You know, it completely changes not only how the Europeans saw Canada, but how they saw the people that they were dealing with, right? It's not at all the same relation of of power. It's not at all the same dynamics, social dynamics that you're building at all. And you see it in Kopwe's writing. You see a lot of this nature writing emerging, right? There, or at least maybe as part of the romanticism, as you were mentioning, romantic poetry was very much concerned with returning to a kind of form of nature in many ways. I just find it interesting. I don't know how deliberate it was, but I just find it very interesting that you bring up exactly the relation to land that's shifting with the Anishinaabeg people, and that's something that would come up so consistently with George Kopwe's writing afterwards.
Yes, yes, well, absolutely. One of the treaty that I know the most about is the treaty that Sir Francis Bond had negotiated with Ojibwe and Odawa chiefs on Manitoulin Island at Manitouwaning in 1836. It was numbered as Treaty 45 before they kind of did a reboot and renumbered the treaties later on. But it is sometimes referred to locally on Manitoulin Island as the Bond Head Treaty, named after Sir Francis Bond Head, but also called the Manitouwaning Treaty. And as I mentioned earlier, George Kopwe spends a couple of pages in his European travelogue taking Sir Francis Bond Head to task for that treaty. And what Sir Francis Bond Head was trying to do with that treaty, you know, that treaty originally gave, as it were, that's probably not the right word to use. I hate words like granted and gave because they suggest a condescension on the part of the colonial powers, or as if they have, you know, the land is theirs to give. But that treaty acknowledged, supposedly in perpetuity, that Manitoulin Island and its archipelago of 30,000 other islands in Georgian Bay would be the sole terrain of indigenous people, in particular of Anishinaabe. And one of the big problems with that treaty from George Kopwe's perspective, and also from the perspective of his erstwhile mentor, Chief Peter Jones, was that Sir Francis Bond Head wanted to remove all of the indigenous people in Upper Canada, including people who lived at Rice Lake and people who lived at the Credit River, and force them to move to Manitoulin Island. And this was, of course, Manitoulin is not as fertile, for example, as the lands around the Toronto area. And Chief Peter Jones is already, you know, his people there at the Credit River are already farming the land, and the government wants to take that land away from them. And so these kinds of coercions were highly problematic and to a great extent disrespectful, as you've suggested. Yes.
We've mentioned a couple of times already that Kopwe was converted to Methodism, right? He would change, I think, to Roman Catholicism towards the end of his life, if I remember correctly, but for most of his life he was a Methodist, much like his mentor Peter Jones. I do find it very interesting, kind of going off of this idea of duality that we've been alluding to, that for a lot of Kopwe's writing, and this I think is a nice segue to start talking about his writing more directly, in a lot of Kopwe's writing, you see simultaneously this intrinsic use of Christian ideology and stuff like that. Like, he is a Methodist after all, but he's also very much concerned with protecting Native culture as he sees it in its traditional form, as he understood it for the first 13 years of his life. So it's this interesting duality that kind of emerges not only in his personal life, but in his writing, that I find to be particularly fascinating.
Yeah. Well, I also find it interesting because he becomes a big advocate for territory, specifically for Native American territory. And that's interesting to me just because it shows his sort of awareness and his sort of, for lack of a better term, Europeanization being turned into the European culture, because he knows what they want is the territory, and now he knows that he has to fight to keep the territory rather than, say, the people or those other things. He knows which part is the important part to get, what the Europeans value.
Yes, absolutely. Peter Jones also makes some really plain statements in which he sort of sees through the ideology of benevolence and paternalism and so on to the, you know, ultimately to what you just said, Mackenzie, the ultimate motivation of British and American governments in North America, which is really to get the land for their own settlers, to develop the land, the whole ideology of improvement, quote unquote, is something that people like George Copway and Peter Jones question in interesting ways. And to go back to what Patrick was saying a little bit earlier, yes, indeed, Copway's Methodism is hugely important, but I think we do Copway a disservice if we think that he is somehow suddenly become a docile Christian. For example, when he is talking about the sale of the Rice Lake lands that occurred the year he was born, it's one of those rare moments in Copway's writing where his discourse drips with irony. He talks about this unfair transaction where his people get a pittance of money for a million hectares of land, and he congratulates the British for their generosity. Irony there. But then he refers to a passage in the New Testament, that a famous scene where Saul, on the way to Damascus, has his great conversion and the scales fall from his eyes. And Copway, in response to these unfair transactions surrounding the land, says, "I pray that the scales will fall from my people's eyes so that they will hesitate in the future to give another, inch of land to the white people." Now, that is the most famous conversion in the New Testament, is Saul's conversion. He becomes St. Paul, the great evangelist, and helps to build the church. Copway invokes this conversion experience to suggest that although his people have been converted to Methodism, another conversion is necessary. And this is a kind of a conversion to an understanding that it is necessary to resist the pressure to give, to basically give away their land. So this is one of the things, I'll just sort of summarize that I find really interesting about Copway's Christianity, and I can say the same thing about the threads of Romanticism that I see in his writing, is that he's not just indebted to them and sort of borrowing ideas. He's using the discourse of Christianity counter-discursively, as a kind of a counter-discourse to combat some of the claims and stereotypes of the colonizing culture.
Whenever I see something like this, I think that's an absolutely integral point to bring up, right? What you were just saying. Whenever I see something like this, it almost runs counter to certain assumptions that you would have about the ability for a lot of First Nations people at the time to speak out against colonizing powers. Is there something to be said about the fact that because he had been converted, that he was able to be so critical from a Christian standpoint? Was that something that he could have done as potently or as successfully as we'll probably touch upon later? George Copway was quite successful for some time as a lecturer and quite well known. Is that something that would have even been possible if he had not converted to Methodism? Is his ability to destroy the system that made him, so to speak, made him what he was at that point, contingent on the fact that the system exists?
Yes. George Copway is one of a number of Indigenous people in North America at this time who become what has been called a cultural broker, a person who has expertise in both cultures, and who therefore is sort of able to communicate, act as a kind of a bridge, if you will, between two different cultures. The fact that Kopwe can speak the language of Christianity is very important for his ability to promote his ability to find a white Christian reading audience, both in, you know, North America and in Europe. If Kopwe can couch a critique of colonialism in the language of the Bible and use allusive language and invoke passages from the Bible while doing that, he has a much better chance of striking a chord with his white reading audience. And it's important to point out that Kopwe wrote not for his own people, but he addressed his books to a white Christian reading audience. And he points out right away that, you know, he himself is a Christian, and he is going to speak a language that his audience understands. I think that your question is a good one, and that Kopwe's Christianity, his Methodism, does give him a way to articulate critiques that he may not otherwise have been able effectively to raise, because people would perhaps just have shut the book or closed their ears right away.
Kevin, you mentioned while we were communicating before the recording of the show that one of the writings that George Kopwe produced that particularly stands out to you was Once More I See My Father's Land, which is a rather short poem for listeners of the show. I'll link it in the description. And a lot of, by the way, George Kopwe's writings is, you can find it for free online if you want to find a digital copy of it. A lot of it is in the public domain. So why is Once More I See My Father's Land something that particularly stands out to you?
This comes from his autobiography. And it's for me, it's a really good example of Kopwe's Ojibwe engagement with romanticism, or romantic engagement with Ojibwe culture. Lots of scholars, lots of historians have pointed out that Kopwe, have suggested that Kopwe is a romantic. And, you know, one of the passages that everybody quotes, if I can use this to contextualize my reading of Once More I See My Father's Land, is the passage early on in the autobiography where Kopwe says, "I was born in heaven's wide domain. The trees were all that sheltered my infant limbs, the blue heavens all that covered me. I am one of nature's children. I have always admired her. She shall be my glory, and wherever I see her, emotions of pleasure roll in my breast and swell and burst like waves on the shores of the ocean in prayer and praise to him who has placed me in her hand. It is thought great to be born in palaces surrounded with wealth, but to be born in nature's wide domain is greater still." You know, this a passage like this would appeal to anybody who loves, you know, British or American or Canadian romantic literature. It's pastoral, it's set in a green space. It does, and one of the things that I love about this passage is, you know, although Tim Fulford has taken George Kopwe to task for calling himself one of nature's children and thereby infantilizing his people the way that Tim reads it, he does, you know, at the same time suggest, he does problematize the binary opposition between civilization and so-called savagery when he says that it's thought great to be born in palaces surrounded with wealth, but it's better to be born where I was born. It's better to be Anishinaabe. He is basically suggesting that to be Anishinaabe is that Anishinaabe being is superior to that of the people who occupy the very pinnacle of the social hierarchy in Europe, you know, kings, queens, monarchs. Once More I See My Father's Land is another example of Kopwe's, of a kind of romanticism in Kopwe, but it's much darker. It's more serious. The poem is elegiac. It's an elegy, which is, you know, basically a poem that expresses one's feelings about a profound loss, the loss of a loved one, or the loss of something supremely valued. And so Kopwe writes, he contextualizes it. He's standing on the very top of the state building in Boston. He's looking out at the busy city. He is looking out at the harbor where the ships are sailing, this world of commerce. And he writes, "Once more I see my father's land upon the beach where oceans roar, where whitened bones bestrew the sand of some brave warrior of yore. The groves where once my fathers roamed, the rivers where the beaver dwelt, the lakes where angry waters foamed, their charms with my fathers have fled. Oh, tell me, ye pale faces, tell, where have my proud ancestors gone, whose smoke curled up from every dale? To what land have their free spirits flown, whose wigwam stood where cities rise, on whose warpath the steam horse flies, and ships like Monidus in disguise approach the shore in endless files?" Now, one of the things that really interests me about the form of this very brief poem is that it follows, or it takes the form of what literature scholar M.H. Abrams has called the greater romantic lyric, which Abrams defines as, you know, a genre wherein an initial description of the landscape or of the changes that the land has undergone evokes a varied but integral process of memory, thought, anticipation, and feeling, which remains closely intervolved with the outer scene. But in the course of this meditation, the lyric speaker achieves an insight, or faces up to a tragic loss, comes to a moral decision, or resolves an emotional problem. And Kopwe, I would love to know, you know, where Kopwe learns his romanticism. It's probably his wife, Elizabeth Howell Kopwe, who introduces him to the romantic poets. But Kopwe isn't just copying, he's innovating on a literary genre here, focusing in this instance on articulating this profound sense of loss. But unlike many romantic lyrics, even the ones that are elegiac, he doesn't arguably find any consolation. So it's like an open wound. It leaves us readers, it doesn't satisfy our desire for a happy ending. It leaves us readers sort of up in the air. I could say one more thing about this poem. When he's introducing the poem, when he's talking about the poem, he actually claims to look out at this great view of Boston Harbor and the bustling city of commerce. And he actually claims that he quotes a passage from Deuteronomy in the Bible. He says, happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, O people saved by the Lord. He seems to be suggesting that the white Americans who have settled Boston and displaced its original indigenous inhabitants are people saved by the Lord, are like people chosen by the Lord. Whenever I see Kopwe quote anything, whether it's a passage from the Bible or a passage of literature from the European literary canon, I always want to go to the original source. So I turned to Deuteronomy. You know, I found that it's interesting to note that the passage from Deuteronomy, from which Kopwe quotes in his poem, or in introducing his poem, in that passage, Moses concludes the blessing that he offers to the Israelites by telling them that, quote, "Thy enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon their high places." Now, Kopwe is standing atop the State House in Boston on, literally, on one of America's high places. He places himself up there deliberately, and he questions, the questions his poem addresses to the pale faces, quote unquote, suggest that at some level he sees the myth of an exemplary America who is like unto thee, as a lie perpetrated by the enemies of his people. There's a lot of tension there for me as a scholar of literature. And so in my new book, I spend a few pages analyzing that particular poem and trying to unpack it. This is something that a literary historian such as myself, it's one of my very, very favorite things to do, close textual analysis based on a formalism that looks at his variation on the greater romantic lyric, and also based on a contextualization of the circumstances in which he wrote. Anyway, that's a little bit about that short poem.
I really like this idea that you brought up of turning conventions on their head a bit, or reinterpreting the Romantics or the Bible, especially when placed within its wider context. And right, adding the element of the context in which he places himself in a heavenly context, I think adds so much more depth to it. Because my initial reading of it was, as you say, more elegiac, but it wasn't exactly trailblazing, if you will, or a reinterpretation of anything that I hadn't seen before. Just looking at it within its pure form, it's a good poem, but nothing more to me. So I really appreciate that wider contextualization that you give. And bringing it back to the idea of heaven, I think it's very interesting that through this poem, he also reinterprets the possibilities of heaven, which is something that throughout the history of Christianity has sometimes come under a lot of heavy criticism by Orthodox thinkers. And I find it very interesting that he's able to position himself in that way so as to bring in what would be considered a different view of heaven as something that's earthly, but that can still lead to a certain form of transcendence.
I think you're right. I mean, there's a couple of questions that Copway asks in this poem when he says, you know, tell me, where have my proud ancestors gone?
Yep.
That's a rhetorical question. George Copway knows,
he knows very well.
They have succumbed to disease. They have succumbed to alcoholism. They have succumbed to poverty. Well, arguably, it's the poverty that helps to promote alcoholism. You know, they've been pushed off their lands. He knows the answer to that question. That's a rhetorical question. His next question, though, when he asks, where have my proud ancestors gone? This is a question that I think Copway asks with more seriousness, because as a Christian convert, you know, he has been taught to believe that his ancestors who had not been converted to Christianity had essentially not gone to heaven, that their souls had, you know, perished. And elsewhere in his writing, Copway says the thought of perishing, you know, how intolerable, he says. And he argues that it behooves the white man to go out into the woods and convert his ancestors. You know, that white people have not done that job properly. Sometimes I wonder how sincere he is in these kinds of articulations. Sometimes, like I said before, I tend to see Copway using Christianity as a counter discourse, you know, basically to say, if I could say so in the simplest kind of way, you Christians pretend to be exemplars of morality, but you are treating my people in a manner that is immoral. And so this is what I mean when I'm talking about using the, you know, religious belief of the colonizer to critique the colonizer's actions and show the colonizer that they are being hypocritical, that they are contradicting themselves. And I think that Copway often does the same thing with poetry as well, with English poetry as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to kind of sum up what you're saying, the question, to come back to the questions that he asks in the last verse, where there's one that particularly stood out to me is, to what land have their free spirits flown?
That's the one.
Both the use of the word land, we've already covered the importance of land, not only to the Ojibwe people, but to George Copway in particular, and to European settlers. But the kind of, yeah, I think irony is a good word in the use of the word free spirits, is a very potent addition on his end, because Are they free now that they've gone beyond the attacks that they've been suffering for centuries at this point? Are they free because of a conversion to Christianity? Are they free because they haven't? It asks all kinds of other questions that I think are much more powerful to the imagination than what a lot of his surface level questions are. Or as you say, they're pretty much rhetorical questions, right? They're not the actual question that he's asking.
I really appreciate your questioning of the word free. I wish we'd had this conversation before I wrote my analysis, published my analysis on the poem, because there's a whole, another inquiry that is happening there that I had not attended to. So one of the things, though, this discussion that we're having, Donald Smith pointed out in his 1988 essay on George Copway, after sort of pointing out a number of the ways in which George Copway misrepresented himself. You know, like I'd said earlier, he claims to be chief Ojibwe Nation. He's not a chief. He claims to still be a missionary. He's not a missionary at the time that he's writing. And there's a lot of other sort of contradictions that Donald Smith points out and problems with George Copway's self-presentation. And that means for Donald Smith and other historians that scholars need to be really, really careful when they use George Copway's texts. So we receive them with a grain of salt. Don't necessarily trust that he's telling us the truth. And in the closing paragraph of his essay, he wrote, to a modern audience, George Copway's real value lies in the man's life story, not in his writings. Of course, as a literature scholar, I have no choice but to take issue with that claim. And I want to say, too, that I'm not critiquing Don. He's been a great help to me over the years, and we've had some wonderful, wonderful conversations. And I do consider him to be, if not the very top Copway scholar, certainly one of them.
One of the things that we're interested in doing on the show, you mentioned that it's called Historia Canadia, is to see how literature questions a lot of our historical assumptions, or how literature reframes historical events as it pertains, in this case, to Canada. And compared to a lot of people that we've covered on the show, Copway is one of those prime examples that we can really deconstruct a lot with in his use of fiction, in his use of tales, in order to construct a history. So I'm actually curious about you specifically as a scholar, right? How do you come to terms with the kind of blurring of the lines between fiction writing or literature, as we broadly conceive of it, and historical writing, right? How is that something that either contradicts itself or blends well together? What does that mean to you to actually write history or write a narrative of history?
Well, I started my literary career not as a literary historian. I was a product of, to a great extent, of the post-structuralist movement in literary criticism. I did my PhD between 1994 and 1998, and I wrote a Foucauldian analysis of William Blake for my doctoral thesis. It was a slow process whereby I became increasingly interested in theory. Is still helpful to me, and I'm not anti-theory by any means. Theory helps me to develop questions to ask of literary texts, but then I want to go into history and ask myself whether or not that question that I'm asking is even relevant, and if it is a relevant question, in what terms is it being asked in the period? George Copway was writing about George Copway was part of this process of transformation for me as a scholar, where I really, became what I call myself a literary historian. I have a colleague in the history department at UMBC who said to me a while ago, it's nice to have a historian working in the English department. And I take that as a great compliment. At the same time, so what I'm interested in doing is trying to understand what was going through an author's mind at the time that they wrote, so trying to read letters and diary and journal entries and get your hands on the books that authors were determining what books they were reading, what poems attracted them and things like that. And then trying to just really contextualize the writings in the way that I attempted to do when I was talking about the contextualizing discussion of that poem, Once More I See My Father's Land. You know, you're correct. I was thinking this morning about Copway. I was sort of thumbing through the autobiography, and really is a huge mashup of different literary genres. You've got the memoir, obviously. You've got sections where he discusses his people's history, you know, and his role in that history. You've got passages of poetry, sometimes quoted from other people, sometimes written by himself or his wife Elizabeth Copway, who is, we should note, probably the friend who helped him to write his autobiography. Some scholars will talk about Copway and Elizabeth Howell's a book, right, and attribute the book to both of them, and that's something that I would love it if more research could be done there. But there are hymns. It's a conversion narrative. He publishes letters. In the British edition of his autobiography, suddenly there are literary epigraphs at the beginning of every chapter. And some of those epigraphs seem to me to be strategically chosen to comment on the chapter. Literature shares with history. The history is interested in the story of telling the story of a nation or nations when they come together, warfare, you know, government, and so on. Literature fiction is also it's storytelling. So, you know, it's not like literature scholars and historians are divorced from each other. We're both interested in stories. We just kind of have, in some ways, a different approach. Let's put it this way. Our primary texts tend often to be different because my primary purpose as a literature scholar is to interpret a literary text. And I find that the best way to interpret a literary text is to contextualize it in relation to the conditions in which it was produced and its reception by contemporary audiences. My book, Transatlantic Upper Canada, looks at a number of writers who wrote both nonfiction and fiction. And I'm curious, so the nonfiction sometimes takes the form of policy documents, things like that, right? And I'm really interested in seeing, for example, Bishop John Strachan, who I mentioned earlier and who I see as having played an important role in the pre-Confederation history of the creation of residential school systems in Canada. He wrote nonfiction, but he also wrote fairly extensively poetry. And it's fascinating for me, and including poetry about Indigenous people in Upper Canada. And so it's fascinating for me to look at his policy suggestions and compare those to the way he writes. Sometimes I find that these kinds of colonial figures seem a little bit schizophrenic, to use that term in a kind of a vernacular rather than in a clinical way, where on the one hand they write this benevolent poetry that praises the so-called noble savage, and you know, and then on the other hand are sort of involved in the creation of policies that are oppressive, right? You know, sometimes, though, I find continuities between the literary philosophies and the, you know, sort of more the drier, if you will, political arguments that I find in literary texts. I think that, you know, Copway's autobiographies, Donald Smith points out, you know, that we need to take some of the things, a lot of the things he said, with a grain of salt, do our homework, try to determine as best we can through the analysis of other documents whether or not Copway is communicating something that we might consider to be sort of true to the historical aspect of his life. But I love looking at the stories and at the fictions because they give me a taste of a writer's imaginative life, and I certainly get that when I read George Copway in context.
That I totally understand where you're coming from with that. This is going to drive Matt crazy that I'm going to mention him again, but when I was writing my master's thesis on Thomas Chandler Haliburton and his book The Clockmaker, that was exactly what I ran into, that kind of issue of, because the whole point of the thesis was his influence, the influence of the clockmaker on a later generation of Canadian imperialists in the late 19th century, right? So it's comparing fiction and nonfiction. And so it became it was difficult to kind of find the line of that, but also it was very enlightening in how a lot of these rhetorical devices in nonfiction that you saw in later imperialists like George Monroe Grant or Stephen Leacock were definitely rooted in the kind of rhetoric and writing devices that you saw in, well, in this case, comedy, or perhaps in the case of George Copway, poetry and autobiography and oral traditions. So I'm always fascinated by exactly what you're talking about. But there's something that I want to pick up on that you were saying. You were mentioning, okay, well, we have to take sometimes these writings with a grain of salt, right? Especially when they so overtly blend many, many genres, as Copway does. And as a literary historian, as you say, you can look at it from a critical eye with a bit of a 20/20 hindsight kind of thing. At the time that he was publishing and writing, how did people take that with a grain of salt? Like, how did people approach this kind of text in your experience of reading and researching George Copway? How did his contemporary audience that you were mentioning, how did they see what he was producing?
Good question. Very good question. George Copway, I've mentioned some similarities between his writing and the writing of the British Romantics. You know, the Romantics themselves, one of the things they were sort of famous for was the way they kind of disrupted literary history.
Yeah.
In the 18th century, during the Enlightenment, a lot of, and this is well before literature was became a formal kind of academic study in universities, but there were a number of I'll call them literary theorists, who wrote kind of rule books about, okay, if you're going to write a pastoral poem, you need to follow this recipe. If you're going to write an epic poem, you need to follow these conventions. For all of the various genres, right? Jacques Derrida calls that the laws of genre. Right? And the Romantics came along and they would have nothing to do with this. Their early readers of a lot of the early readers of Wordsworth and Coleridge, for example, and certainly Blake as well, who was not famous like Wordsworth and Coleridge, a lot of early readers objected to the way that these writers would experiment with and defy and violate the laws of genre, so that you have like Wordsworth writes an epic poem, but it's a lyric poem too. And generally speaking, the epic and the lyric are considered, very, very different, two kind of diametrically opposed forms of writing. And Copway, I think, when I look at the way that he mashes up the genres in his autobiography and in some of his other writing, bringing to bear memoir, anecdote, history, poetry, hymns, conversion narratives, letters, epigraphs, all of these things, at the same time engaging discourses of romanticism, Christianity as counter discourses, I see a lot of experimentation in Copway. And it's probably one of the things that excited me when I very first came to his books, before I kind of knew anything about him. There will always be people who will object to this kind of experimentation, but I think that Copway's Christianity and the way that he presents himself as what Donald Smith calls the noble Christian convert, right? Not a noble savage, but a noble Christian convert, that the Christianity is in the forefront of his self-presentation enough that his contemporary readers kind of allow him, don't object to the mixing of genres. And I mean, his autobiography went into 7 editions, including one edition that was published in Britain. It was truly a bestseller, and George Copway was truly a literary celebrity, and one of the very first international literary celebrities to have been born in what we now call Canada, right? Yeah, I hope that answers your question a little bit. These discussions of genre and experimentation excite me immensely.
One of the ideas that comes up to my mind when you were mentioning this is, while his writing for a long time, as you say, was relatively well received, he's noted to have been a part of, or at least in contact with, many well-known writers at the time. Longfellow.
Yep. Right. James Fenimore Cooper, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, exactly. Francis Parkman.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, it's always interesting to see the limits of the acceptance of certain, well, I'll broadly encompass it as behavior, right? Or certain forms of writing, right? Whereas experimentation in literature, perhaps as a result of the fact, as you're saying, that it wasn't totally codified like it is today, or a specific study like we see it today, but he was allowed to maneuver within that sphere, right? Quite freely, as you were mentioning. But Copway is also noteworthy, and it's one of the reasons why I think he's an interesting figure. He's also noteworthy for his kind of fall from grace. I don't know if you have much to say about that actual fall, why he would have fallen, but I think from what I've read of it, it's rather enlightening as to what the limits of native writers, despite being Christian, despite playing the rules of the quote-unquote rules of literature at the time as it was accepted in the Romantic spheres, up to where can you be a rebel, so to speak, an artistic rebel? I don't know if you had anything to say about that, about his fall from grace, so to speak, why he's no longer as much of a talked about figure.
Yes. Well, his audience was fickle. You know, when Copway burst on the scene, he was something very new to the, white reading audience that flocked to his autobiography. Like I said before, not a noble savage, but a noble Christian convert, somebody who combines, or who at least presents himself as combining within his being something of that kind of nobility, that idealized indigenous identity that the Romantics presented on the one hand, and a Christian on the other. Just like nowadays, occasionally you will have, someone will make a big splash in the world of cinema or in the world of pop music and end up being kind of a one-hit wonder, if you will. Copway, for a while, was able to sustain that interest. There's only so much he could write about being a noble Christian convert. His audience, they something else new came along and they lost interest in George Copway. So this was part of the problem, the fall from grace. But at the same time, too, Copway was engaging in some rather questionable activities, taking some liberties, if you will. For example, the poem, The Ojibwe Conquest, that was attributed to him. We now know that that poem was in fact written by an American Indian agent named Julius Taylor Clark. And he and Copway decided to put George Copway's name on it because they figured that it would find a much broader reading audience. I can't tell you how excited I was when I first found, oh my God, George Copway wrote an epic poem. I read that poem the first time, not having a clue about it, the circumstances of its production. Plagiarism is nothing new. Samuel Taylor Coleridge was quite famous for plagiarizing the German idealist philosophers. And we still read Coleridge today. In fact, he's one of the most well-read British Romantic poets. Lord Byron was, to quote Lady Caroline Lamb, mad, bad, and dangerous to know, a highly controversial figure. That hasn't stopped us from reading him. So, if someone wants to bring a moralistic attitude to George Copway and sort of cancel him, if you will, because he, I would find that highly problematic. But having said that, one of the things that I think would be a worthwhile scholarly exercise would be for a scholar of, a literary historian such as you or any of your listeners to have a close look at the poem The Ojibwe Conquest and see what's going on there in terms of the way it represents indigenous people. Because, George Copway, he articulates in his other writings certain positions that I suspect a white man writing a poem about the Ojibwe conquest would possibly contradict. It's been a long time since I read that poem, but I seem to recall some European Eurocentric stereotypes entering that poem. And so the big danger is that Kakwe runs the risk of attaching his name to a discourse that is oppressive. So I think it would be interesting to do a close reading of that poem and to compare the way it presents Indigenous people and Indigenous history with the way that Kakwe himself talks about these things in the writings that we know that he produced with his partner, Elizabeth Howell. And to search for those, to have a look and see if there are contradictions and ultimately, there would be, I think, some important insights there about the perils of this kind of thing, of Kakwe engaging in this kind of act, plagiarism.
Right. Well, I just found an essay topic for next week anyway, but
actually, I have a question though. I was just sort of listening to you talk, Kevin. I was wondering, because you referred before to the fact that Kakwe sort of has this one hit wonder burnout, and then he sort of, his name was the only one put on the epic poem to increase sales. Would he have been a case of tokenism then? Accepted tokenism?
Huh. Yes. I mean, there are a couple of points in Kakwe's life history where he seems to be willing almost to take on that role, mm-hmm. Not just here, but also, and Donald Smith writes about this in his essays on George Kakwe. George Kakwe actually became a member when he was living in the United States of the Know Nothing Party. And the Know Nothings were anti-immigration, they were anti-Roman Catholic. There were white people who referred to themselves as Native Americans, somehow or other, Kakwe comes into their company and they express a great deal of interest in him. And he ends up becoming a member. I mean, this is a society that has secret handshakes and so on. And if you ask someone, the society does, the response is, I know nothing. In affiliating himself with a group like that, George Kakwe seems to give an Indigenous stamp of approval for that sort of thing. And I think he also sort of becomes a kind of a token Indigenous person in that context. This is a good question, Mac.
What I just find is there's a lot of the controversy has been fascinating to me when I was sort of looking at it, sort of the fact that he was accused and convicted of embezzlement by the Indian Department when he was, after being elected as a vice president of the Ojibwe Council, is kind of a fascinating thing to me. But then later going on to be an advocate of North American territory, he seems to have these conflicting interests constantly where he wants to do one thing, but then he gets smacked in another way, almost as if he's trying. It's almost the first case of a person trying to put on a front or a fake persona for the public to generate some sort of popular opinion about them.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, this is, Kakwe is in literary theory, we often talk about how identity is performative. Yep. And certainly, I think that's a really good way to think about George Kakwe. He performs his identity. Sometimes he refers to himself as a Native American, and he means as a Anishinaabe mm-hmm. man. Sometimes he calls him, he refers to himself as a loyal British subject. Sometimes he refers to himself as an American, affiliating himself with the settler culture. He's a kind of a shapeshift, and I find that really interesting. It keeps us on our toes when we are examining George Kakwe. But it's also important to point out, you mentioned the embezzlement charges that he faced, a couple of them, and it wasn't just the government that charged him. Some of people who lived at Rice Lake remembered him, the young man who had, perpetrated a wrong when he was in a position of responsibility at Rice Lake. So yeah, we need to take all of these things into consideration when we study Kakwe. The fact that Kakwe is a bit of a literary bad boy, like Lord Byron, whom he admires so much, just makes him all the more interesting to me.
Oh, for sure. Reading his little biography that we have and the sort of history, my first thought was, where's the movie about this guy? Where's the story? Just sort of taking a look at this, you almost have the different like two-act structures that you would have in certain plays where you see the rise and the fall of George Kakwe.
it would be a fascinating subject for a movie. I totally agree. He lived an interesting and in some ways a kind of tragic life, you know, falling into poverty, losing, he and his wife lost several of their children.
Yep. I think only one of them near the end.
Yes, yes. And you know, he apparently started drinking. There's a moment near the end of his life where he calls himself a pagan. And I find that really interesting. It's as if he got to the point where, you know, the noble Christian convert thing was no longer working for him. And he perhaps had become very, very disillusioned with that aspect of his personal experience and decided to refute it. Toward the end.
Yeah, it was a funny little moment. Me and Patrick, we often talk way before the show during the week when we're sort of putting things together. And one of the things that we talked about was the dark irony that Copway was often somebody who talked about how Europeans and Americans used alcohol to weaken the First Nations people and so on, and sort of how tragic it is that that seems to be his own downfall, and that's what he fell into near the end of his life.
There's one of my favorite passages in Copway. He says, you know, he's addressing this idea of this quote-unquote vanishing Indian or, you know, vanishing American, that notion that was quite common, almost universal, I think, in late 18th century and early 19th century, that idea that indigenous nations were inevitably going to become extinct. And there were a lot of writers, Susanna Moody is one of them, who says that, you know, she suggests that there's a mysterious agency at work that is, you know, slowly killing the indigenous people. It's almost as if it's part of God's plan. And Copway says, give me a break. Well, he doesn't quite say that, but I'm paraphrasing him here. He says, the white man steals our land, gives us alcohol to, you know, basically the equivalent of a kind of a drug pusher, if you will, to get us hooked on alcohol to destroy us. And then claims that some kind of providential, mysterious agency is at work that is killing us. You know, once again, like, give me a break. And these moments in Copway where he becomes indignant are some of my favorite moments. I really feel a lot of sincerity and energy happening in those
for
moments.
Sure. The true Copway. Yeah, it's always interesting for us because when we looked at the treaties, when we were looking at, we both found this recurring theme of First Nations people being almost treated like zoo animals confined to certain bits of territory. And then now the use of alcohol to add onto it as a sort of sedation method, almost in the same way that we try and keep animals calm, dangerous animals calm in a pen. And this sort
I actually have a discussion of George. I'm really interested in what he has to say about animals. And I have an essay in University of Edinburgh Press's companion to Transatlantic Studies, one of the companions they've published, where I talk about Copway in the context of a greater discussion of the representation of animals in this period in North America, with a particular focus on Upper Canada. You know, animal studies, critical animal studies is one of the real burgeoning areas of interest in literary studies these days. And I think Copway is someone who, an analysis of Copway could be really helpful to these kinds of studies. There's a wonderful scene in George Copway's European travel book where he visits the London Zoo and he comments on the animals who are there. And check out his discussion of the eagle. Of the bald eagle that is chained, you know, it's in a cage. And Copway, he has a kind of a conversation with it, where he starts by referring to the bird as you know, in the third person. But you can see that Copway himself is identifying with this caged creature. And, you know, at the time, he is a real celebrity in London. He's complaining. When he gets home from the zoo or back to his flat or wherever he was staying, he complains that the English are demanding way too much of his time. He's engaged for dinner for the whole week and all this kind of thing. And I get the sense that he sometimes felt that when he was on his tour, that that white audiences, that the curiosity that they brought to bear in his performances was similar to the curiosity that someone would have when entering a zoo.
Fascinating. Thank you very much for those interventions, Mac. Those were.
I figured I had to say something. I was falling behind. I was just trying to keep up most of this time.
I figured we could start winding down. So one of the last questions that I want to talk to you about. So you started the conversation, Kevin, by saying why you got interested in George Copway in the first place. And we've been kind of alluding to it throughout this discussion that we've been having. By studying and reading George Copway, this figure that compared to, say, other Native writers like Peter Jones that you were mentioning, or even a slightly later than the period we're talking about, right? E. Pauline Johnson is a really well-known First Nations writer. Why did you think it was important to revive Copway at this moment in the field of literary studies? And what's left unexplored that we can learn through him? Like, what are some paths of exploration that you think are relevant to George Copway, and why should we, you know, could you keep reading him, basically?
Yeah. Well, one way I could answer that question is maybe to talk about my teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, so I am the romantic literature specialist in the English department here at UMBC. And I have begun in recent years, and George Copway played a really important role in this. I've begun to include selections from George Copway's writings, and from the writings of Jane Johnston Schoolcraft, Bemwewe Gijikokwe, in my second year romantic literature survey. I want my students to know that romanticism is not simply this thing that's happening in Europe at the time. And my students really, really like this literature, you know, so I think that it's really important for us in the wake of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada and the publication of its report for teachers, for me, I won't talk about us, I'll talk about me. It's important for me to make sure that my literary syllabi are inclusive, and I want to shake things up. I also teach George Copway in the context of I actually assign reading from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada's final report. The introductory chapter is the very first thing that I read in that I assign in my third year course on post-colonial literature. And although, you know, we're not talking about post-coloniality in relation to George Copway, I have begun to assign selections from George Copway in a course such as that. I'm planning for next year to teach a senior seminar, undergraduate seminar here on Romanticism in Upper Canada, which is going to have selections from Chief Peter Jones, from George Copway, possibly from Catherine Soniga Sutton, Jane Johnson Schoolcraft. I think, you know, in the wake of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, it's really, really important for Canadians to engage with that report and to engage with the 94 recommendations that were published in that report. And by revisiting literary history from a perspective that includes writers such as George Copway, we Canadians can become more aware of aspects of our history. For example, we need to challenge the myth that Britain and Canada have historically treated Indigenous nations with great humanity and sympathy and respect compared to the United States. Anyone who has read any of the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission will know that is a myth. So engaging with George Copway in this way, bringing him into my research and then bringing that research into the classroom is a really important way for me as a scholar to try to be an ally.
As this kind of extension of what you were saying, I personally believe that it should go much further than beyond the classroom. This idea that Canadians still don't know the trauma that these people still go through on a daily basis. And, you know, for most people, and I certainly haven't read in its entirety, I've read parts of it, but most people aren't going to read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in its entirety. Right. So I think George Copway, absolutely, and just to echo your point, is a great way to not only engage with this kind of new ideas or at least a different perspective as to the history of Canada, but also to engage with the idea that this is nothing new. We have a sense that exactly what you were saying, for historically Canada and Great Britain treated the natives fairly and correctly and compared to the United States, and that it's only recently that they've started that the First Nations as a broadly cohesive group have started pushing back against this. But this is not true. It's been going for hundreds of years since the start of European colonization. And I think this is an excellent and powerful and especially a really beautiful way at times to go about this, right? That's at times hard hitting, but I think at least more engaging than what a lot of people rightfully consider like a dry report.
I would love to see a Canadian Indigenous filmmaker make that film. You want, I can't remember, it was you or Matt who mentioned the idea that there needs to be a film, because that would go a long way to helping to popularize, to bring people's attention to someone. You know, for me, I have no problem. I actually, you know, I enjoy watching the latest, you know, literary or film remake of a Jane Austen novel or a Frankenstein or something like that. Because as far as I'm concerned, as a teacher of literature, the more interest in literature, the better, right? Mm-hmm. But it's always my hope that these kinds of, you know, popular cultural works of art will have the effect of bringing people back to the primary text. And so I would love to, it would be wonderful if, you know, there was a way for, if someone could find a way to make not just George Copway, but,
many
contemporary authors as well to a widespread public attention.
Well, we're touching on something we've sort of dubbed as the Canadian arrogance in regards to social equality and social issues. There's always this common thread of, oh, we're doing better than America. And what that's, I mean, as a professor, I'm sure you'll say getting a D, which is better than an F, still isn't good. You know, and that's sort of how, that's our sort of viewpoint. Yeah, we're doing better, but if you're getting a 4 out of 10 and the guy that you're comparing yourself to got a 2, that's not much of an improvement. Yeah, that's still a failure.
You know, I another thing, of course, that I forgot to mention, you know, I moved to the Prince George campus of the University of Northern British Columbia in the year 2000 after finishing a postdoc in Southern Ontario at Western and doing my PhD and my MA at McMaster University. And I grew up in Southern Ontario. And moving here to Prince George has also helped to shape my research. I work at an institution that has a large mandate for Indigenous education, and research. And, you know, a lot of my students are Indigenous people, Aboriginal people, members of First Nations. And I owe it to my students to try to make my syllabi more inclusive. And that's an ongoing process on my part. It's humbling to read text by people like George Copway. And I think that it's, you know, really necessary for someone like me. I'm teaching a class in Romantic literature, and a number of my students are Indigenous students. I would be remiss in not bringing someone like George Copway or Jane Johnson Schoolcraft or Peter Jones into the mix.
Definitely agree. I'm studying to be a teacher right now. Patrick's the academic, and then I'm sort of the educator, and that's what I'm English literature or English language arts educator, and that's one of the things that I'm most concerned about going forward. And one of the things I really want to start shaping and changing is just shaking up the syllabus. You know,
yes,
changing
yes.
it from the same 5 base texts that we teach at a high school level or primary school level.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm saying 100% agreement.
Yes, yes, yes. The so-called literary canon. Yeah. It's definitely an ongoing process and a really, really important one.
Instead of just reading Shakespeare for the 50th time, we can maybe knock off 30 times and throw it to somebody else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, don't tell my partner's a Shakespeare scholar, so we won't mention that to her.
Well, I love Shakespeare, but it's if we want to educate Canadian students about what they should be studying in Canadian as like Canadian people and Canadian literature, you First Nations people like George Copway are immeasurably more important than William Shakespeare in our sort of specific area.
Make an education that is hopefully relevant to our mm-hmm. our students, for sure. Yeah, and to their experience.
I had one final question, and I didn't write this on the ones that I sent you, because I'm pulling this from another show that I listened to, and I think it's a really interesting way to kind of go into final thoughts. What did we not ask you, and why would that question be important, and what is possibly the answer to that question?
I'm probably going to get in my car and drive away later and drive home and say, oh, that was the thing. I think that you've done a really good job asking me, you know, various questions. Perhaps the question of what research remains to be done in George Copway studies, because, you know, Donald Smith points out in his 1988 essay that George Copway has been relatively, at that point in time, relatively neglected by scholars of literature. Even though he grew up in the same area that Susanna Moody and Catherine Parr Traill settled in and homesteaded in and wrote about, and, you know, they've become sort of canonical, canlit figures, Copway is generally at that time ignored. And it's been wonderful for me to see this. There's a burgeoning of interest in George Copway's writings within literary studies in recent years. And that excites me a great deal. I think that more work could be done in literary studies contextualizing Copway in relation to a history of environmentalism and ecological consciousness in Canada. I've tried to do some of that research myself, but I'm sure that plenty more that could be done. I'd like to see some research contextualizing his writings much more closely than I have done in relation to the history of Canada's residential school system and the imperial policy heritage informing that, you know, pre-Confederation history. George Copway, for example, in his pamphlet titled Organization of a New Indian Territory East of the Missouri River, where he was proposing to create a very large 30,000 square kilometer indigenous nation that would hopefully one day become a state in the Union in the United States. Copway in that essay talks about the need to stop teaching indigenous children their own indigenous language. That Copway's relationship to the history of residential school systems, it seems to me, would be something that a scholar with some cultural inwardness in particular could do a really important study of. Because I think that we see contradictions in his writing. He may claim, for example, that Indigenous children should be taught the English language and taught to forget their Indigenous language. And yet elsewhere, he argues that the Ojibwe language is way more poetical than the English language, and that there's more poetry sometimes in a single, you know, word in the Ojibwe language than there is in a whole paragraph of English writing. So, you know, sort of weighing these kinds of things in Copway would be very, very interesting. And I'm sure there's more work to be done contextualizing his writings in relation to the Romantic tradition. I've written a fair bit about focusing on Europe and Britain in my I'm not a specialist in American, what I call American Romanticism, you know, that work by people like Fenimore Cooper and Longfellow and Parkman and looking more closely at Copway's, not just his relationship with these people, but looking at the way that he engages with their writings in his own literary texts and the way that they engage with his writings. You know, the fact that Longfellow's Song of Hiawatha, such a famous poem, it's about Ojibwe people, and Copway was the only Ojibwe man that Longfellow ever met. So that kind of thing could be a very, very interesting study. And then at the more maybe literary theory level, more work on the performative and shifting nature of George Copway's self-presentation, his identity.
Fascinating. Thank you very much.
I hope I've been able to communicate a little bit of my enthusiasm for, you know, I do live in British Columbia, but as I said, I grew up in Southern Ontario. Maybe I need to start becoming more of a British Columbian and try to write a book that's similar to my Transatlantic Upper Canada book and look at a similar history out here in Western Canada.
Right.
But I always read and teach George Copway with a great deal of exuberance because he's an exuberant writer and someone who lived the most interesting life. I think there's probably more room to talk about his European travels as well.
Absolutely. Well, before we leave, is there anything that you want to say to the audience about your future projects that you're writing on or working on currently, ways to get into contact if you so choose? Is there anything that you want the audience to know about yourself and your work before we end the show?
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think that you've talked about my new book, Transatlantic Upper Canada, Portraits in Literature, Land, and British Indigenous Relations. I've mentioned it. It has a preface in which I do my best to articulate my motivations as a member of Canada's Settler Society for writing such a book, and some folks might be curious to check that out. My current project grows out of my research on transatlantic Upper Canada. I have an insight grant to write a study called The Life and Literary Adventures of Sir Francis Bond Head, and right now I'm writing about Head's Argentine travels. He wrote a very famous bestseller Argentinian travel text, but that whole project is moving in the direction ultimately looking at Sir Francis Bond Head's relationship with Indigenous nations and people in Upper Canada during the period in which he was Lieutenant Governor of the province. And so I'll be able to write more about the Manitoulin Island Treaty that he negotiated with 16 Odawa chiefs on Manitoulin Island in August of 1836. But I also haven't looked in any kind of detail at the several other treaties that he imposed. And so George Copway will find his way, I'm sure, into that study, given his own critique of Sir Francis Bondhead. So I am continuing at this point in my research with my fascination for Upper Canada. Sir Francis Bondhead is a romantic man of letters, a literary celebrity in his own right, who comes to Upper Canada in 1836 with a head full of romantic ideas and proceeds to make policy and to negotiate treaties that are informed by his romanticism. So I am continuing this kind of exploration of romanticism and its manifestations in Upper Canada for my current project.
Well, if transatlantic Upper Canada is any indication, which again, I've been finding very fascinating so far, I look absolutely forward to your analysis of Sir Francis Bondhead. Once again, Professor Kevin Hutchings, thank you very much for joining us on the show. This was a good first try at having a professor on the show, so thank you very much.
I would come back in the future. Thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure to meet you both, and it's been great to appear here on Historia Canadiana. Like I told you, this is my very first appearance on any podcast anywhere. I hope it won't be my last. So thank you for helping me dip my toes into the pond of podcasts.